Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
Life is full of personal wins, whether it's cleaning your house, getting that dream car, or checking off your to-do list. Winning at life is a great feeling. And with the State Farm Personal Price Plan, you can keep winning when you create an affordable price just for you by bundling home and auto. So give yourself a round of applause. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Hey, hearty welcome to you to the Nerdist Podcast, episode number 57. The song playing underneath my chatter is by Earthrise Sound System. It's called Rama, and it's on the album Turntables on the Hudson, Lunar New Year Edition 4707, available on iTunes. A couple things up top. Our guestless podcast was a resounding success. So thank you for listening. We will continue to do a second guestless podcast episode each week as long as we can. Guess freaking what? My old roommate Will Wheaton is finally going to be on the Nerdist podcast after only a year. We are going to record this live at the Smodcastle. Yes, Kevin Smith's Smodcastle has generously donated itself to us. We're going to do this February 9th. That is right around the corner. There will be probably a little less than 50 tickets available, so you will want to make sure and hop on that business. Also, I will be performing stand-up comedy jokes back up in San Francisco at the Punchline March 2nd through the 5th, so please come out to that. Also, I will be appearing at South by Southwest Interactive this year around March 14th and 15th. More details on that later. And then I'm heading to Chicago March 16th through the 19th to perform at Zany's. And if that weren't enough, on April 8th, I'll be in Chicopee, Massachusetts, and then April 9th, that's a Saturday, I'll be performing at the Wilbur Theater. So come to one or both of those shows, and I promise good times will be had. For more information and ticket links to these shows, go to Nerdist.com and then look in the sidebar under the heading, Look at Me! All right, let us move on to episode number 57 with the delightful, the brilliant, the lightning quick, the coiffed, the bespeckled, the huggable, Greg Proops.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Better?
Yes.
Alright. It's so weird how
easily this thing's set up and then a podcast happens out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not like the old days where you need a tower and a transmitter and a mountain to build.
They were saying the same thing then. All we need is a tower and a mountain. You used to have nothing.
Just not
you just have to rub the sticks and the blanket. A series of mirrors across Europe.
We're here with Greg Proops.
Series of mirrors across Europe.
That's how they transmitted messages. There was a series of telegraphs. On mountain up to mountain.
And there was semaphore for a while.
Weather fogged that in.
Now, what happened? Because we were in here in the green room. We were just recording some other stuff. And the front door of the Punchline was open. And then I guess they decided to lock it, and so when you showed up, the door was locked.
Well, I asked someone who was working here, and they didn't understand me, and because of my lack of inquisitiveness, I believe there was a sign up that said the kitchen door's open, but why would I go look at that when there's an obvious clue in front of me, and why not just wander the streets of San Francisco with bitterness for Chris Hardwick in my heart, ever growing, and then, of course, floodingly released.
Good, good, good. It was released, and then... Did you have to jerk it out, or did it just dissipate?
No, as soon as I knew that you were here, I was like, oh, I'm an idiot.
No. Well, yeah. There, you know, there is, I mean, we have to remember that there is a conservation of energy of hatred, so it didn't just go away. It obviously has, like, there's still the same amount somewhere, right?
I'll direct it back on myself where it belongs. I want my bile duct to be purple and bulging.
We're at we're still at SF Sketchfest, and Greg, you and I are about to do the Benson Interruption.
Oh yes,
yeah, which is going to be at 4:20, of course.
And then after that, he is doing the Meltdown.
He is doing your Meltdown show, yeah. But by the time this goes up, that'll have already happened.
And you were great.
You did a great job.
I am tremendous.
Yeah.
Actually, I am very excited to see you on the Interruption show because of anyone who's been on the Interruption show, and I've probably done the show like 20 times. Yeah. I've never seen you do it, and I am dying to see you with Doug.
It's my favorite stand-up show in L.A., and I always told Doug that. It's funny that we would have done it so many times and never seen each other on it. It's my favorite one because immediately you start a premise, the flow is, you know, staunched, and you have to go another way. So it forces digression, and that's all I want to do as a comedian. My goal is to digress, so for me it's like the perfect show. Because I'm never married to anything. I'm, you know, after you've heard your routines a few times, you're like, I get it.
Yeah. You know?
I don't mind if, like, someone stops me and so I can change tack, you know.
It is an almost separate skill set to be able to do the same jokes night after night with the same level of energy and not go quietly crazy.
I always felt that was the true measure of a performer. You know, like a comedian that's a great performer will be able to manufacture a reasonable facsimile of themselves every night without the emotional, if you'll pardon the expression, bullshit that we put ourselves through and get up on crosses and freak out about this and that. And then, oh, I hate my life. And then you go up and kind of take it out on the crowd. At least I do every night.
But that's part of why your shows are so fun.
I know.
That's watching you kind of, you know, it's almost like watching teppanyaki, where you're just in front of them just like dicing up and then throwing the shrimp with the knife.
Onto the hat.
Yeah, exactly. But, there are so many rooms. For some reason, you're a benchmark in my head. And when I get into some rooms, especially if I'm in the Midwest or just, you know, towns that don't have as many comedy-savvy people.
Yeah.
And I always go to you in my head of, like, what would Proops do? And I feel like you talk at the crowd in such a way that is almost challenging to, like, you're almost daring them to not get you or to fuck with you so that the real animal can come out and the real surgeon can go to work. It's almost Jack the Ripper-esque.
Well, I just really feel like a lot of the responsibility has been misplaced in comedy. Why does the onus have to be on us all the time? You know, shouldn't they carry the weight? It is a comedian audience situation. And yet, you'll find we do 80% of the work.
Yeah.
Shouldn't it be 50-50?
Should be a little 50-50.
For the 1% of the gratification.
Exactly. Matt Weinhold once said, my whole act is I tell one joke and then I spend 10 minutes telling the audience why they should have gotten it. And I think that's what I... And then the guy at the Laugh Stop in Houston, I've forgotten his name. He was so nice to me. Said, he's in Texas, you know, I just start in on him. He goes, all you do is piss on them and they love you for it. So, but that's the key. I don't consider it pissing on them, but I think you slap them around and then they really do like it because they're being taken seriously.
Oh, yeah.
I elevated them to my level, right? We're fighting as equals, not as I'm dominating. I'll tell the audience I'm going to dominate them. In Atlanta about a month ago, I was kind of having a bloaty little drunk week, and one of those ones, you know, where you're like, okay, I've been on the road for ages, and I got up to do a set, and I just wasn't getting enough out of the crowd, and I went, I would rather I die. I'd rather we all die than this set go poorly. I listened to it back the other night. I don't listen, you know, you tape your set.
Of course, then you never listen.
So I was listening to it, right? And I heard myself say, I would rather we all... I go, you know, I stop in the middle of the set. You guys are not good. I want you to know that right now. I've been up here for 25 minutes, and frankly, you're not doing it for me, you know? And they like go, what? And I'm like, no, seriously. This isn't about you, you know? And, like,
was it at the Laughing Skull?
Yeah, it was at the Skull.
And did that pull them in?
It did because it exploded the room to the point where they couldn't resist at that point.
That's a very difficult. that's a very difficult thing to do. We just had this talk the other day about, you know, is it a good idea if things aren't going the way you want to acknowledge it with the crowd?
Always.
But sometimes I feel like it directs them, and if they weren't feeling that way about it, then it sort of puts them into that place.
Oh, yeah. No, you're absolutely right about that, and you can overdo that shit early on. I mean, my very best friend and the genius Warren Thomas was the king of, if any comic laughed at an obscure reference in the back of the house, that was the end of the show, right? Like, then he would just go into the crowd. Or, you know, 2 seconds into the show, he'd, you know, see someone and it would fuck him off. And he'd, hey, what are you, the Shaw's bodyguard? You know, and boom, the show's over, right? Like, you can't, and then he'd go, where'd he lose him? His big go-to. But sometimes he'd do where'd he lose him when he was killing, you
right.
know, which is also funny, but it does, like you say, direct them. And I feel like I do that too sometimes. It's a little too early to start bitch-slapping people.
But right? I think it's sort of like that's high level black belt comedy. Like yeah. if you're a new comic and you kind of do it, it does. But if you know what you're doing and you're experienced enough, you can still make it work.
I would say at a corporate gig when it's do or die, it's probably best to forge onward and never show. But it's always about confidence either way. Confidence will out. I don't think there's another quality in comedy. Obviously, funny is good.
That helps.
But as friends have said to me, it's not necessary to be funny to be a successful comedian. But it doesn't hurt your career.
Right.
It can hurt your career if you're too funny, quite frankly.
I agree.
Some people are too funny.
If you're too funny and you know, and I'm not saying this is, I'm not giving this a value judgment, but you know, you look at a show like Arrested Development, which I think is obviously one of the greatest, most complex pieces of television comedy in the history of television, and you know, it just sailed past most people, and I think that was a case of, I think that show might have been too funny for America.
Well, it only went 2 years, was it?
Three.
Yeah. Well, for that kind of show, that's almost and conversely, whatever, Two and a Half Men, whatever you can think of, runs 9-10 years, you know?
Right.
Well, that's always how it
according
was.
To Jim.
You know, in the 60s, they used to decry that Andy Griffith was on for 10 years, and there was all those Hayseed shows on CBS till they bumped them all and put on MASH and Mary Tyler Moore and put the sophisticated comedies on. But those shows did awfully well.
Yeah.
And everyone who grew up in that era, and even the people who didn't because of the reruns, remembers all of them. Yeah. Green Acres and the Beverly Hillbillies and Andy Griffith and when you look
Petticoat
at the structure
Junction.
Right, when you look Petticoat Junction too, because it had the hot chicks, but when you look at the structure of like Green Acres or even Andy Griffith, it's beautifully written and put together.
Mm-hmm.
Over the years, of course, it gets corny and trite, and you know, the reason everybody started to hate on it, but it's like,
and then Norman Lear happened.
And then Norman Lear and all of a sudden relevance. And then we never got that back. Relevance is replaced by rudeness and switching around teabag jokes from the kid to the mom. And, you know, like, not every show. Obviously, there's some tremendously well-written comedies on TV. But, I mean, the schlockified ones are just like, you know, those haven't changed. There was 1,000 schlocky ones on, too. I Dream of Jeannie and shit. Which I love.
I love that show.
I did too. I loved it.
If I could get a Bewitched, I Dream of Jeannie.
Bewitched, buddy.
Bam!
I will watch any Elizabeth Montgomery. You can't give me bad Elizabeth Montgomery. And when she played Serena, off the hook.
I mean, that's when the pants come down.
Yo, dude, that was slutty cousin time, man. Slutty cousin.
And, you know, a lot of people don't remember, like, you know, before the 80s, you couldn't pause. You record anything and
pause it.
You had to like stealth jack. Like you had to be.
It was a sprint rather than.
Yeah, it was like it's Darren. Yeah, fuck. Yeah. Oh.
It was carpe diem phallus, man. There was no no waiting around. No, you had to strike even in the Baywatch early days because you couldn't slow it down, baby.
Well, they did it for you.
That's what it was. Oh, that's what those were. Those were jerk montages.
Yeah, exactly.
Where you could just really give people the opportunity.
We're gonna show them run down the beach. It's like no. Let's take our time with this one.
Oh yeah. It takes forever to get there.
How long should they make the montages? It was probably like some weird decision on
Baywatch script was 27 pages
on Hasselhoff's part. You know, it takes me about 90 seconds.
Seven yellow pages and 45 green pages.
So let's make all of them that way.
Yeah. Exactly. Oh, of course, it was a decision.
When did you start work? When did you start doing stand-up?
44.
1944.
We were showing Fritz a thing or two. I'll tell you that much.
Yep.
I started in college, probably. Well, as a kid, and then high school, and then. Late 70s, and then as a professional, early 80s, mm-hmm. like 82 probably. I was in a team with a guy named Forrest Brakeman, who lives in Los Angeles, or rather, up in the hills of Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
I won't disclose his mountain area. And Then we did a team that was very frenetic and unfunny, as all teams of 22-year-old guys are, you know, just nonstop, right? No room. We listened. We got drunk years ago and listened to a tape of ourselves. Not a videotape, by the way. A cassette audio tape. That's when it was recorded. No, it wasn't an acetate, you know, half-inch tape. Okay? Not Buddy Holly. We
spin the reel. Change reels. Change reel.
Oh, they caught fire again.
You're going to lose that girl. Take four. Boom, 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 boom.
So you guys were listening to the wax cylinders of your
Yeah, right. We were listening to... The sound you hear is the sound of my voice. I wish to be known. This is my last will and testament before God. Yeah, we dropped in Edison, and there was just no room. Like, we didn't let the audience, and I think that's one of my faults anyway, is that I go too fast a lot of the time and don't take the golden moments, you know, like, I'm not going to be like Tig or Todd Berry or something, but I love that they go slow and let, as Bob Hope said so brilliantly, let it lie there.
I'm not comfortable with that.
You're frenetic.
I'm a super like, yeah. I have to fill every second with something and don't give them a chance.
Me too, and verbiage. And,
yeah.
So give them a chance to figure out that there's not...
Over-decorating the jokes with words, like to do.
I had a friend said it's anytime you're on Letterman, if you're performing stand-up on Letterman, just if you just wait long enough after a joke, people will just start applauding.
Yeah.
And like I went back and watched a bunch, and like you see guys like taking their time on Letterman, because if they just wait after a punchline, it just the laughs turn into applause.
Subway sandwiches! Thank you.
He killed. What did he say?
Subway sandwiches. Did you hear?
Oh, it was a great bit.
Is Letterman still dismissive of the clubs? That was the thing that always hacked me off. In the old days, he'd have comics on, which he rarely does anyway, but when he would have them on, he's playing, you know, Uncle Frickle Frogs, and he'd act all superior to it. And I always think, you weren't that great a stand-up. I don't mean to be a dick about it. You're a genius television performer, obviously. You're like Steve Allen or whatever, but golly.
It is the bane of every comedian's existence, though, when you go on to promote your club, and it's a ridiculous...
Slap happies.
Yeah, slap happies. Chuckle farts.
Yeah.
And and you have to say it seriously, because you know that... You know, a lot of these clubs take it very seriously, so if you're, you know, you will get the call from, you know, I do not understand how you can make fun of the Chuckle Farts name.
Yeah.
My granddaddy. Uh-huh. We work very hard, and you're like, I know, but it just sounds so ridiculous.
Yeah, Chuckle Flatulence till we changed it.
Yeah.
It's not fair. I'm a comedian. You're dangling it in front of me. What do you expect me to do?
Like the Chuckle Flatulence would just have very old-timey parchment, like very scripted.
You can't throw a steak in the ground and slap your dog for diving forks.
It was the Chuckle Flatulence shop PPE.
Yeah. By the permission of the king.
Yeah. Sons.
Wow. There was one in the 80s. I never played there. There was that magazine, Just for Laughs, newspaper, whatever, in the old days. And before the internets, it had a giant listing of every bloody club in the country, right? In the middle of it. That was the big, you know. And one of them was Sir Laughs a Lot. And that one always made me laugh harder than Chucklehead or, you know, Connections. There's punchlines everywhere, obviously. The Stress Factory in New Jersey, and I always said, does that mean to alleviate or to induce? By calling it a stress factory, you're posing more questions than you're answering.
Now, I'm wondering, when did Laughs a Lot become knighted?
And under whose orders? Whose flag do you ride under, sir?
I don't.
Sir Laughs a Lot. I mean, wow, right?
Do you think everything is a joke, Sir Laughs a Lot?
Sir Gagahad? I mean, it is. That's weaky. Weaky doodle, though, just really weak. And I like the ones that don't even, like, there's one called Connections with two X's.
Mm-hmm.
And,
sounds like a strip club.
It really does sound like a strip club.
Connections or by
dating,
the airport.
A dating club.
Yeah.
Is it? The jukebox in Peoria. And there, I don't recall that there's a jukebox, but there's a drawing of a rendering of a jukebox on the wall.
Well, there's
want to elicit the feeling.
Yeah. There's crackers in Indianapolis.
Crackers.
There's Rooster Teeth Feathers in Northern California.
Roosters, yeah, yes, there is Rooster Teeth Feathers.
Rooster Teeth Feathers.
It had the it had more going on stage in the 80s than any club. Like, you know, the stuff hanging from the ceiling, like Ye Olde Curiosity, Willy Wonka, you know.
Yep.
And then when you were the MC, you had to hold down so many announcements. Fortunately, they didn't have video, but. It would be like, you know, the business card in the spittoon, and Tuesday night was this.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say this, and Tony, who I worked for years, whom I adore, they made more fizzy, junky, fruity fucking $7 milkshake crap drinks than any club in the world, right? Like, it was all couples from the South Bay, and all of them drank, you know, I'll have a Buffalo Stampede or whatever the fuck. You know, they would be like, you know, Ramos Fizz, grape soda, Chambord, chocolate ice cream. Like, oh, fuck, really? Like, there was a full-on, the drink-making area was, you know, like D-Day.
Half the club.
Yeah.
It was like but a Ghirardelli's.
They had cabinets to put the blenders in. It's the only club I've ever, you know, here, if someone, no, they don't do blender drinks here, but you work clubs where they do blender drinks.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you hear fucking, your mother gave you Ritalin, and you went, and you're like, okay, there goes that
golden dollar. They pulse it.
I just hate the bartenders that also don't time the shake. It's like,
I heard that at Cobbs. I heard that during our podcast.
Oh, yeah, the Cobbs, they're just heedless. But you remember in San Francisco, singular to any city, that there is so little regard for what you're doing and when I'm doing something else.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that to be bad. I love all the staffs I've ever worked with here, but they don't fucking, hey.
No, they're there to work.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's
get your jokes done there, Jokey.
You're there to distract people long enough to want to buy food and beverages. I can't remember what club. I was at some club where it was the credit card machine was really loud, so it would be silent up until, like, you know, 15 minutes before the show was over, when all the checks, you would hear, as it would print out every show.
And then the sound of them pulling off the little dotted lines.
You ever had to have them turn off the 1, TV, 2, video games, 3, close down the pool table, you know?
When we do these like, arty alternative shows at bars in Los Angeles, and it's like, okay, we're going to turn off the Bears game. Here's some comedy.
Yeah, I did that there was some bar in Santa Monica, and like there was a Monday Night Football going on, and the guy is like, all right, let's get the show started. I was hosting. Like, get the show started. And I was like, cool, are you going to go announce the show, maybe turn off the TV? He's all, yeah, you can do that. So I go up, and then like I turn off the TV, and I hear like a guy going, what the fuck?
Yeah.
You know, it's very uncomfortable.
Who turned off that TV?
Exactly. The tall nerd. Now, time for jokes.
Get him. That's what they say.
You know what's weird about dating?
Yeah, exactly.
I've had that so many times, especially when you play taverns. And and sometimes you go like, let's wait till the end of the game, and they'll do it. And other times, oh no, we're going, and you think, no. Pool tables are the worst because drunk men with cues, that's like stage yellow or whatever. You don't ever want to have to tell meth dealer types to put.
And they will
there.
They will hit harder to challenge your authority.
They will. Yeah, they will.
Because what are you going to fucking do about it?
Yeah.
Well, at least it's not a batting cage.
That's true. At least you're not doing stand-up in a batting cage, which is what it feels like some of the time.
There was a gig years ago, Sweet River, Sweetwater, I can't remember, Modesto or somewhere. He had several of them. And the performing area had been cobbled out of where a table had almost been once. So it was a restaurant, in essence, with shit going on everywhere and no cease of it whatsoever. It was like that scene in What a Way to Go with Shirley MacLaine, where she marries all the guys. When she meets Gene Kelly, he's performing in a restaurant and no one's paying attention to him. He's doing a clown act and like people are eating, hey, I got your steaks, you know, like over him. And that's what this place was like. I remember them bringing the garbage down to take it to the dock in front and then right around you, you know.
Oh, that's terrible. Dragging
the, and like, anyway, the art of comedy is one that's been pursued by both Will Rogers and...
bathrooms behind the stage. Have you ever seen that?
Oh, yeah.
So recently,
right there.
Like, yeah, exactly. Right, so, sorry, here you go. And, you know, you can make someone fun of someone once and make a joke about it, but then after a while, you're just like, it's just going to keep happening. There's no reason. People have to go to the bathroom.
I was like, there was one place in L.A., I think it was in the Valley, the show doesn't exist anymore, but it was at this place called Lulu's. Do you remember Lulu's Beehive? And, it was a coffee shop, but the stage was right next to the front door.
Yeah.
And so you'd be on stage and the people would just come in, and either, if you were lucky, they would just breeze by, but almost every time they would stop. Oh,
yeah,
is something... and you would have to go through that numerous times.
I didn't mean to interrupt your poetry slam. I'm sorry.
Well, the old Tiger Lily that was in that Cuban restaurant.
Yeah.
I would walk in there, and literally a couple just stop and turn up and be like, what is this?
Yeah.
And you're like, I'm in the middle of my... And you're on the floor there, too.
Yes,
the
you're
floor,
on
the
floor.
I had that shitty, that one light that they put on top of the bar.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
So you've seen comedy evolve and change.
And then devolve.
And then devolve. I mean, so if you start in 82, you got to experience the comedy boom.
Oh, yeah.
And then you got to experience the comedy non-boom of the 90s. So what did that, what What was it like? What did that feel like?
Well, in the 80s, when I started, it was, I thought, more, there were more mad people and real eccentrics and people who were almost marginal, not only in the way they could interact with other people, but as comics, you know, like there were more kooks, mm-hmm. and weirdos, like legitimate ones. And there's only so many now, I think.
That was after Reagan signed that bill.
Well, it was just allowed to start comedy.
Well, it's just sort of a supply and demand. If there's a ton of stage time everywhere, then all the people who were just doing basically the kooky open mic shit, I would imagine, yeah. like, oh, actually, that guy just did Evening at the Improv because they need to fill the spaces.
And then it got really glutted as almost a career choice, and people started to choose it, and then... You know, the usual common thread that everybody repeats endlessly. Because L.A. is a demanding place and stand-up became a viable way to get on TV, then there were people who did it just for that reason and all that. That's always cited. I always felt like it's the broadest avenue in comedy and that everyone does it at the beginning. And then I watched all of my peers and subordinates, quite frankly, become writers, producers, actors, and do, you know, those who wanted to do stand-up stayed the course. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they even wrote books or did a show or whatever, but they carried on doing stand-up. But the people who weren't that great at stand-ups but were great writers or great whatever became writers and producers. And I think that's the natural flow. Like, almost everybody, like Craig T. Nelson, you know, you think of all these people on TV or whatever that you heard of, or Barry Levinson, from the director, you know, they were stand-ups, and then they...
Right.
Found the Judd real Apatow, thing that they're Judd Apatow. Like, it's not uncommon.
Mike
at
Nichols.
All.
Dan Patrick Nichols.
Yeah, Mike Nichols, most notably a genius. Improviser.
Woody fucking Allen.
But then he got really glutted in the 80s, like you said, and then they were putting everyone on telly, and then the quality of acts kind of, and then when that exploded, it was good because everybody stayed who could stay, I think. What happened was the people who weren't making a great living or didn't have any TV got washed off, and I think that happened again a few years ago. But then I think the grooviest thing about comedy is that when I started in 82, nobody made one or two comedy records every year or two was a hit anymore. But that's the end of the age of vinyl, right? Because by the late 80s, it's all CDs, and then no one's really doing it. Then Chris Rock probably had a few, comedy albums that sold two fucking records, or Adam Sandler or somebody.
Right.
But now, because of the casting of the pod and the interneting of the web, we are... this is better than it ever was. Like, when I was little, I grew up on albums, listening to, George Carlin, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think now everyone can do their own album every week on their podcast.
I agree.
And you can still do albums, and people still want to hear that material that's different than your podcasting material. Mm-hmm. So the opening up of the audio market and the interest of young people, which is the important thing, that people in their 20s and 30s and teens want this and need it, like I did, you know what I mean? But there was a period when nobody wanted to listen to audio comedy as much as, you know, you did it anyway, but it wasn't a big fucking deal.
It's like, could you imagine now going back and having this catalog of Richard Pryor every week sitting down for an hour and a half?
I mean, what's great is that there's still, even though it's a much more convenient discovery process, that there is still a discovery process, and I think, I think so far, from what I can tell, the iTunes algorithm is pretty good. Like, if you listen to our show, you'll probably enjoy Comedy Death Ray, you will probably enjoy Marin, you will probably enjoy Pardo, and, you know... And so it really is it's just having people try to manage all this stuff at once, where, you know, I would get my Steve Martin album, and that was the only thing I would listen to for months on end.
Right. Right.
And now it's very disposable. Comedy is sort of like the comedy, like podcasts have made comedy albums. Podcasts were like the disposable razors of comedy albums, where it's like, you can throw them away, it's fine, you got another one.
It's like the radio shows of the old days, but more people have a chance. The problem with the radio shows of the old days was, one, hardly any women, or of course no black people or any other ethnicity was allowed to be on them, but two.
Amos and Andy.
Yeah, who were white.
Who were white.
What?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
Oh my god.
Yeah, they recast it for
that
TV.
That changes everything, that was horrible.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's more egalitarian now in that way, I think, because everybody can do it. And, there's way more to sift through, way more to sift through. But having said that, if you look at the iTunes, for better or worse, you see that Mark Maron and all these really smart people are holding down their slot, and it gets more popular, not
Maron
less.
Earned it, and what's did so he, fuck? He really did. I mean, you know, if anyone deserves to hit it, you know, I sort of feel. I mean, I know a ton of people that I feel like deserve should hit it, but Mark is, you know. His podcast started off okay, and, you know, everyone knows that when you launch a new podcast, it goes straight to the top because that's when you get your most, your highest number of subscribers is in the beginning. And then a lot of those podcasts fall off. It is a fucking chore to maintain it. And he's steadily crept up to the top, and it's really been incredible.
And now it's like This American Life and WTF, the one and two.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah,
it's like crazy. You're quite right. No, I'd rather he be up there than anybody else because he does a great job.
Yeah.
But that's what I think. This is the heyday, and the next 10 years are of the audio comedy dominating again. Mm-hmm. And I think that's beautiful.
It really is interesting.
We took it away from television, and that's the most important part. Comedians have the comedy back in their hands now. I feel like in a real sincere way. In the 80s, you were putting everybody on every 5-10 minute fucking show. You could do 100 shows where you did 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. Now that's all gone. Mm-hmm. And the television shows that they do put comics on are largely irrelevant. No one, it all gets covered in the wash, you know. There's nice guys who put comics on, but it's just not as important as...
No.
If you had a regular TV show like Chelsea or something, that's, you know, a beachhead.
And I've done that show with you a couple times, and it is a fun show to do, and what I enjoy about it is that, like you said, it's one of the few shows that actually lets comics come on and fuck around, and that just does not happen on television that much anymore.
No, it's not. But we, by the podcast revolution, I think comics really now everybody can do what they want, and we don't. I mean, Mark's getting written up in the New York Times, and quite right, but no one's putting him on TV every week yet. You know what I mean? But the podcast thing is going to be... Right. The podcast thing is so important that he's going to get that chance, I think. They'll be forced to fucking look at the sheer numbers. And, you know, remember... I don't want to we get into show business too much, but... You, more than anyone, because you're the Nerdist, the TV people are not as tech savvy as they ought to be.
Maybe not.
They listen to their kids when they want to know what the fuck's going on.
Yeah.
And their kids are listening to your podcast. You know what I mean?
I remember pitching... I pitched a Nerd Culture show years ago to television, and...
Kittens.
And they said it was...
How rude of me.
Oh, that's all right.
No.
I pitched a Nerd Culture show years ago to television, and they said it's too niche. And I said, yeah, but don't you guys see what's coming? Everyone has the internet. Technology is, you know, is booming. It's people are buying video games or outgrossing films. Like, niche culture is pop culture now. Like, it's this niche is now pop culture. Yeah. And... You know, they ignored it, and of course now here we are, you know, in 2011, and it's fucking pop culture now.
Yeah, movies aren't as popular as games, and they just still don't get that either, really.
Which is shocking to me because you think, you know, you think a lot in the industry like, well, they're just motivated by money, so wherever the money is. But in a way, it's like trying to fucking flip a 180 in an airliner. You're like, you know, it's just a slow turn to try to pull the reins back a little bit.
It's the most stubborn people, too.
Yeah. Well, they're at, I mean, like a lot of the people who run stuff at higher levels, they're older people, they're a little out of touch, they're focused on the business side all the time.
They want their iPad to print wirelessly.
They look at market, I mean, like, they're basically reading the Matrix all the time. They're looking at code all the time. And so they don't, you know, they're not on the street. They don't see what's happening.
And they try to understand it, but that's the thing I don't understand is these people, people over 50 are the only people that care about their shit printing. Like, their technology they have, they get that kind of, and then they want it to print. They want to print.
The analogy that I love to go back to is, you know, when Hollywood makes a really formulaic thing and it's awful because they didn't understand it, I always reminded of the scene in Jeff Goldblum's version of The Fly where he keeps trying to send live creatures through and the machine just turns them inside out. Yeah. And it's because what he realized was that machine's version of what a living creature was. It didn't understand, and so he had to teach it. Like, he had to teach it the preciousness of life. And so, like, that's the same thing.
Yeah.
When Hollywood tries to make a thing they don't understand, they just... That's why it just feels like a fucking flipped inside out baboon.
You mean everything in 3D?
3D! Yeah. Come on, 3D! It's such bullshit!
1950s.
Oh my god,
that's the buzzword that they're hearing on the streets from the kids.
And consumers are not fucking having it because no one's buying 3D televisions.
No.
And I'm so glad because I've always known it's bullshit.
Yeah.
We'll that one failed on its ass, I think.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, like, you know, we'll see what happens with the 3D gaming because the Nintendo 3DS is about to come out. And people say it's great, and that might be the precursor to home 3D entertainment.
I get it for gaming. It makes sense for gaming. But, you know, for to have people just... so many people just bought HD sets, and they're like, now I have to buy a 3D set, and I have to buy all the goddamn glasses.
It's
and
if so gimmicky.
If I have five people and four pairs of glasses, one person's going to watch blurry television. Like, it just...
I don't go and see them in the theater. I don't want to fucking watch it at home.
Yeah. You know? It's not... They still can't get it right.
No. It's like you say, they're not... And not that I claim to be on the street, but I'm often in the world amongst people, and I think that people who don't do their own laundry or pick up their own mail or make their own phone calls are a step away from what we might call reality.
Yeah, maybe that's
and
true.
I think that doing those things is your life, and that sometimes you got to take the car in.
Yep.
You know, and that's not someone else's job. That's your fucking job. And having personal responsibility is being a grown-up, too.
Yep.
As well as making giant decisions based on fucking graphs and meters and charts. And they make Avatar, and, you know, now everything's 3D. And it's like, no, that was a singular thing. And they threw a gimmick on it that was an old-fashioned gimmick. And, you know, real old-fashioned. Like, you know, like in smell-o-vision old-fashioned, you know.
Like when they show an image of, like, old people in movies in the 50s, they show the image of, like, all those people with the 3D glasses.
Oh, yeah,
like,
man.
We were so dumb back then. It's the fucking same thing now.
Yeah, but ours aren't paper anymore. They're plastic. Yeah. And
they're awesome.
They're gray and they're black. You know, when I was in college, when I first started, you know, writing and trying to do stand-up comedy, I was a huge Whose Line fan. Huge, huge, huge. I mean, like, that was the British Whose Line was one of those shows that really helped define a certain kind of comedy for me.
And it helped Comedy Central pad their schedule.
Yes.
It was on all the time.
Yeah, they played it to death all the time.
And it really, you know, it was on every day, and every day after class, you know, my roommate, who at the time was Will Wheaton, and I would watch the shit out of it.
Yeah.
I'm going to get accused of name-dropping again. I'm sorry for that. But
not just any name,
too. It's not his fault. His college roommate was Will Wheaton.
Yes. Yeah. I just thought it was relevant. It's a relevant thing to know. I think people would be entertained to know that Will was a huge Whose Line fan. And just, you know, watching you and Styles and Mike McShay and Josie and Colin Mockery and Clive Anderson, how did you get involved with that show, and what were the tapings like?
I was doing stand-up on the road with Tom Kenny, who's now SpongeBob.
Yes, he's been on the podcast.
And we were in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, and dying on our ass, and then we were staying in a condo in Spokane, Washington, the two of us. And we looked very similar in those days. Lots of hair and giant glasses.
And the glasses.
We were, in fact, two big faggots from San Francisco who were out in the middle of Shit-Kickerland in my giant Buick, right? Drove around together. So,
Just like the B-52s.
Yeah, I mean, really, man.
Driving out to the love shack.
We couldn't go into coffee shops sometimes. You know, it got icky. But anyways, we go... I get a phone call from McShane, and he goes, hey, man, there's this English show. It's some fucking improv thing. They're in San Francisco auditioning. Where are you? And I'm like, I'm in Spokane. It was all sad. So thank fuck they came back the next year, and then I got to audition. And I even remember when I got it. Like, you know, you audition for a lot of shit, and you don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember being on stage and saying something in an improv and hearing them all laugh and thinking, I think I got it. Because the line was real funny and they all laughed, and I went, I think they, you know, got it. And then I got, so they went over and did one. This is 89, and I'd never been anywhere, like out of the United States, you know, traveled to Europe or anything. And I liked it. And then we carried on for 10 years in England.
Wow.
And we, the last couple series we shot here in Hollywood, and then the American one started up in like 99 or somewhere in there. And we did six for the summer. It was an actual summer replacement series for something that got dropped. Talking about the old days, right?
Wow.
it was like, you know, ABC doesn't do it much, but they were taking a chance then. You remember, this is the pre-9/11 world. And people threw a lot of money around in those days. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like now in show business. That's why there couldn't be podcasting then, you know? Aside from the technology, it's like... the money kind of fucked it all up. It's the desperation and lack of money, and it's forced us to be resourceful rebels who live in a cave and come up and eat frogs and whatnot. You know, and have a band. We all wear headbands at night and fucking, you know, the secret handshake, you know, by the moon, you know. And when the otter rises, shall I? Yes, you may pass. But the... so then we did it for 10 years in England, and it was... We did six, and it got good ratings, because... they put it on in like August or something, and it was on Wednesday nights or Thursday nights at 8, and it got okay numbers. So they went, oh, I do a series. Mm-hmm. But the first one was just like nothing. Like ABC went, well, we'll see how this fucking works. They were convinced though. Drew was a 900-pound gorilla at ABC at the time, mm-hmm. and that's why it happened. Ryan Stiles and Drew made it happen.
I auditioned for Whose Line in 2000, and I got. It was a whole day, and it was the most grueling audition that I've ever been in my entire life, and. Yeah. And I made it through the whole day. The way that the audition process worked was, you'd show up at like 10 a.m. and it was a bunch of people, and then they would just start playing improv games, and then throughout the day they would just start cutting people.
Yeah, like Chorus Line.
Yeah, so there were like three or four sessions. There were three or four cuts. Jesus. And somehow I made it all the way to the end of the day, and I thought, oh my god, I think I made it on. And then what I found out was, you have to do that like five more times. Like Jeff Davis said, who ended up being on the show, is a phenomenal improviser. Yes. He did it like five times. He had to do that whole day of improv games that many times, and they didn't call me back after that one day. So I made it through the first day. I did not make it past that, but it was. I've never been more fried in my life than after that day of improvising.
Extraordinary process. I had to do it a few times, but Jeff's in the, I'm in a group with Jeff now. We just played, well, not as of the podcasting day, last night.
You guys, I heard it was like two sold out shows.
Yeah, it went really well. It was fun. And that's where I met Jeff on Whose Line. And I remember the very first one he did, we were sitting outside before the show, and I said, man, you're the coolest person that's joined this show since me.
So because you both wear suits.
Well, and you wore a suit at the beginning too. They used to really make you jump through hoops. He brought a couple guys over to England once from Australia, and then we would do before the show, we'd play some games, you know, just kind of fuck around and try to hone a couple games, and with the producers, but. You're always auditioning on every show you're on, as you know. You can't go to a table read or anything and fucking slough it off.
No, they'll fucking cut you.
If you show up 2 days in a row late to something, they're like, well, we get you're not interested.
Right.
They don't even say anything. It's just, you're gone. You know? Right. There's no, your parking lot's been obliterated and, you know, you can no longer speak. So these guys, we did some games. And I guess they were thinking, well, fuck it, you know, I'll save it for the show. We'll just, let's run through the games. And they weren't funny enough at the fucking, like, you know, rehearsal or whatever you want to call it. And kaboom.
Really?
Yeah, back to Australia from London, which is an all-day flight. Oh, one day, geez. One whole day around the world.
That sucks. Right?
And they didn't, you know, he just like, nah, I'm not confident enough to use you tomorrow or whatever, you know.
Holy shit.
Yep.
That's a long flight home.
And if you were ever sick, you'd always go, Dan. But Dan was the genius behind it. You're sick. Are you going to make it? You know, like, you'd freak out.
Right.
So one time I remember I wasn't feeling well or I was tired or I came in dragging ass. And you could never do that either. You couldn't come in dragging ass. You had to come in $1,000, right? Because, so I came in dragging ass. And I said to somebody, can I have a cup of tea, you know? And, and he, are you all right? You know, and I'm like, yeah, I'm all right. Get off my dick. And so we did the show. And I came in to see him at the office like the next day. And I said, who was the funniest last night? And he went, you were. I made him say it though. I had a really good show. I just needed a cup of coffee. Like I said to him, I wasn't sick. Right. I needed a cup of coffee and something to eat. And once I had those two things, I went back to myself. You know, just one of those long days. You know, like, but you couldn't have a long day. You know.
Yeah. How many did you tape a couple shows at once or just one?
Well,
show?
We'd shoot one and play like 25, 28 games, and then he would cut it up, and that's where Dan. Wow. That's where the majesty of Dan's craft. That people go, you're improv, you know, like, yeah, we made it up. They cut out everything that didn't work. It's television.
Right.
So some things didn't work occasionally. But having said that, shoot 28 games, shoot for about 2 hours and 45 minutes, and get 4 or 5 half-hour episodes out of it.
Oh, wow.
That's the economy of that show. So when, by the time we got to America, we were able to do that. So after we went off the air, there was another season or two on ABC Family of new episodes cut from what we had left over.
Oh, oh,
that's how economically our show was shot. Literally more than a sitcom, like wall to wall, you got almost everything, which means it speaks to, one, how good the cast is, right? Ryan Stiles and Wayne Brady, I mean, like, never fail. Like, never, you don't, you know, they didn't really fail. Mm-hmm. And that's at improv. And if you did fail, I would just swear. That was always the way out, right? You go, fuck this, and then cut. And then you got to do it over. So there was a way to kind of stop it, stop the avalanche,
yeah.
Which you had to do sometimes, because we'd be doing a hoedown or some goddamn thing we hated. And I know the crowd loved hoedown, but like when people still, up till a couple years ago, kept yelling it, and Ryan would go, I hate your hoedown right here. Like, Ryan hated the hoedown beyond all measure. Plus, Ryan was in the four dog, right? So when you're improvising, you know that when you're doing a topic and everybody has to do it, by the time it gets to you, if you're fourth in line, the topics are, there's a bonfire, right? And you just see
you've burned
everything. Yeah. And you're singing a clever song that's two couplets or whatever. Here goes the first guy. There goes that. The second guy. The third guy's had to dig deep.
Yep.
And you're the fourth guy. Now what do? Like, make a song up about yourself, you know? And Ryan always had to do that. But so we do hoedown. And I always went first. And so you have to be fucking, they'll go like, it's the traffic hoedown. And then bum, 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 bum. That's how much time you have.
Oh, shit.
To go, I was driving yesterday, you know.
That's, right? Now, in that moment, I mean, your approach, I mean, you're obviously super fast, and you can get words to come out of your mouth very fast and articulately. But was there any sort of, like, what, can you even, you can't really think at that point. At that point, are you just saying in your head, whatever comes out of my mouth is what's going
to
happen.
Sometimes, and sometimes you were lucky enough to be able to come up with the first rhyme, and then hopefully it had enough legs that you could kind of fucking get something going off that. Mm-hmm. Or if you're really lucky, the punchline would spring fully blown into your brain, and then it was a matter of not fucking up the four lines to get to it. Because you're improvising, and if you think of something, it's harder to say it than it is to just say it and then think of it, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
So there was, and that was when I would stop and reset. If I'd do two and they chewed it, I would go, fuck this shit. And then we'd all stop and then we'd have a minute and we could fucking, and then let's try it again. Like, because you'd never do it in a club and you would never do it in a theater.
Mm-mm.
But on TV, this is how it functioned, you know. So we didn't cheat, but there was a way to make it work, kind of. But I believe it was the quality of everyone that he cast on the show. Not that you wouldn't have been perfectly good. There's 1,000 improvisers that would have been.
Truthfully, I don't think my improv games are that good. I was surprised that I made it as far as I made it. But I don't think, I'm not sure I would have sustained on that show.
It's also a really specific, I mean, you know, now we're really in Nerdist talk. This is like for improvisers and people who like improv. Whose line is a specific type of
very
improv?
Very specific, yeah.
Improv, as we know it, is practiced by lots of different people in lots of different ways.
And if you go to the Groundlings, they teach one kind of improv, and the UCB teaches that, you know, that Del Close kind of improv, which is separate. And there's the Herald, there's long form improv, and there, which are different than quick improv games. And you know, if, because being a fan of Whose Line, I took classes at Groundlings for a little while. I was and they would always kind of slap you on the nose if you went jokey, which is what you are programmed to do if you're playing improv games, I think, because you're just like, quick in, get out. But they want you to develop characters and story and not get in the way. And
so we never did that. And so I've met people over the years. Most people are, of course, lovely. But I've met a few improvisers who really didn't think much of our show because they were like, it's not proper improv. You know, and how did guys in Chicago, of course, where it's sacred.
Right, of course.
Go.
It's don't not, talk about improv or pizza in Chicago.
Right,
they'll tell you all about
or
how you're wrong.
And shit. Yeah. And so, you know, it's not proper improv. And I'm like, I'm the first to agree. We do a real highly agitated short form. And because I did it with those guys, and we were lucky enough to be on the TV show, I still work with them, right? It's Ryan, me, Chip Esten, and Jeff Davis.
Mm-hmm.
And we all did the show together, but not as a foursome. But we do the format, not the format of the TV show, but we do short games. We don't do big, long, character-laden things. We do games, so it's a comedy show, mm-hmm. as fast and furious as humanly. When we don't, you know, we wouldn't do, And this is no knock on everybody else who does long form. Like, I did ASCAT with the guys in New York and LA, and they're fabulous, you know. And that's really long form, extrapolated off of stories and shit like that. We do short everything. And because we're together so much, we can... And then to me, the fun of it is not the games. I could give a shit about improv. It's the banner, you know, because we'll go, and this next game is for Ryan and Jeff. And, like, we don't know each other. You know, like, we do vaudeville, right. You know, Barton and Lewis, you know. The looseness of the show is what makes it fun. I always thought it was funny in theater sports and comedy sports that there was rules and referees and bagging and blocking and all that. Mm-hmm. And the times I've had to play it, I always broke every fucking rule and made sure I got bagged and then took the bag off and threw it on the floor. And, like, this is what I think of rules in improv. The point of every exercise on stage is to be funny. Mm-hmm. Funny. If I want to see process, I'll go to a fucking rehearsal.
Right.
You are up there to deliver goods like Joe DiMaggio. No one came to see Joe DiMaggio take imaginary cuts in his room. Fucking score touchdowns, you know what I mean? And so I understand all the kinds of improv because I've done them and stuff, but I don't even think of myself as a great improviser. I think I'm with Ryan Stiles, and Ryan Stiles is a great improviser. So because I'm on a team with Barry Bonds, and I can bat third, fourth, or whatever, fifth, you know, I don't have to hold down the I'm like Ringo. I can just fucking, if I keep the beat and, you know, do my part, and I'm selling something different than him.
Yeah.
And that's the compliment, you know, we compliment each other. But, like, he's a great improviser because he keeps scenes going and he stays in character. He sets a place up wherever he goes. He never just wanders into a scene with nothing going on. He knows what he wants, what he's going to get from you, all in his mind without thinking about it, and hits fucking one-liners out of the fucking ballpark one after the next. Yeah. Like, that's great improv to me. I love when people are in character. I love when people can do whatever, but to see someone be funny through a whole scene of improv
it's a very specific thing to do. Like, you know, especially if you watch guys like sort of bleeding over into sketch, you watch guys like Fred Armisen, and you just have I have such a huge respect for people who never acknowledge that they're in a comedy scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That they no matter what happens, they're in it. And even if shit gets fucked up, you know, like breaking the fourth wall, they're still dealing with it as that character in that scene. Yeah. And I'm the first, but we did two music shows last night at Cobb's, and I did this thing as Elvis Costello. Yeah. And in the first show, I tried to come out and sell it as Elvis Costello. And I'm just not good at that. So the second show, I was like, yeah, I came up with this character. It's Elvis Costello doing this, and here it is. Like, I'm bad at expressing things through acting. I need words. I need words.
Yeah. Yeah.
I need words and exposition.
I agree. I think it's I can do characters too, and I can act, but I always think, I don't know. To me, I don't think acting is easy. It's hard to do, but I don't think it's as hard as actors make it out to be, especially as much as show business makes it out to be.
Right.
And it requires, and I know people will hate me for this, acting requires no intelligence whatsoever. It requires a great deal of intuition, and you have to be agile in an emotional way.
Mm-hmm.
It's the reproducing of conditions and the reproducing of behavior. It's behaving convincingly enough so that it sells.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with your intellect. You have to be able to remember a script, but that's not exactly a fucking hamster could remember if they could speak.
Right.
I'm not saying all actors are stupid either. Some are geniuses, obviously.
Right.
I'm sure Jack Nicholson and Robert De Niro are, well, albeit nutty.
Yeah.
They're not like low level.
James Woods has got like 180 IQ or something. Well,
there you go, James Woods. And who doesn't want to roll with him all
weekend?
I mean,
seriously.
And bring your girlfriend with you, because I'm sure she'd have fun too. but you know what I mean? Like, that's the amazing part to me. Because people always say being a comic must require a lot of intelligence, and I think it requires some, because you have to have a point of view, but that's all degrees, isn't it? You know, but actors, I think I've known some people who were stick, bone, stone, bust out, fucking stupid, who were the greatest actors, make you cry. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it's a real acting is real particular. I mean, I'm not saying, like I say, I know a lot of actors and they're quite bright, but that's not necessary. You can be literally as dumb as a fucking bag of hammers. If you can fucking on camera do that thing that makes the audience focus on you, that's all it requires. First of all, it's what you look like as a screen actor, way more than anything else.
Absolutely.
There's nothing else. What you look like is paramount, and then can you act?
That's the secondary. Like,
because people who are not just great looking, more weird looking, that's important too. There's so many actors who are just funny looking, and that's why they're great.
Yeah. I can think of a couple.
Yeah.
And Paul Giamatti.
Ron Perlman.
Yeah.
Steve Buscemi.
Exactly. Yeah. So they can all back it up, too. They can do
that.
There's this guy in LA, Sam Christensen. I've never taken this class, but people talk about it. And you're supposed to know your hero. And I guess, I don't know what the process is. I'm fucking this all up. But I think they get in a group, and then everyone else tells you, what. Like, we would all say, this is what I think of you. You come off like this. And I always think, well, if you've been in show business a long time and you don't know what you come off like... you should do this at the beginning of your career. I mean, I understand doing it to refocus or whatever, but like, I think there's some truth to it probably because, like, I'm doing a podcast called The Smartest Man in the World. And the reason I chose that is because a comedian friend of mine named Phil Bowman said to me, you should do a podcast where you're the smartest man in the world. You're so pedantic and you're so funny that way. Do that. Because I would have never thought of that. I would have never thought to call it, you know, like, I mean, of course I would. I'm always that way. But, like, it required someone pushing me to do it. You know what I mean? And I was glad they did. And I took someone's advice. How about that? I let go of how smart I
am. Interesting. You know, sometimes that shit works.
You know what I mean? When your friend says to you, this is funny.
Yeah.
And I thought, no, that if you see it that way, then everybody sees it that way. And no one will think, what a dick. And no one said, what a dick. Mm-hmm. You know, you really think you're the smartest man in the world? I was like, oh, of course. You know, my favorite one, though, somebody wrote a comment that was like, more like the boringest man in the world. And that one, I loved
that. How about Everybody Hates Raymond?
Yeah.
Well, we stayed up all night, but it was worth it.
Yeah.
We are at about our hour, and we have to go do the Doug Benson interruption.
I know
show.
We have to go. I'm so long winded.
No, not at all. This is great. I get accused of talking too much, so I'm glad when someone can make me not talk.
I know, but I wish it was funnier instead of deconstructing improv.
No.
That
it
had
is
to be a
fascinating. No, I'm telling you, people who are nerdy about comedy, who are a lot of people listen to this podcast. That's the kind of stuff they want to hear. They want to hear your point of view. They know they've seen you. They know, like, that, you know, they enjoy your comedy, and it's literally interesting to me to hearing about all the Whose Line stuff, and, you know, because improv isn't something that I really do anymore.
No.
So it's fascinating for me to hear how it works from someone who knows how to do it. But we're gonna go do the Benson Interruption show, and what can we promote for you on the podcast right now besides the Smartest Man in the World podcast?
Well, when does this one go out?
This will probably go out in a few weeks.
Oh, okay. So then, Smartest Man in the World, and that's on iTunes. And then I'll be on Chelsea, you know, every now and then. I think I'm on in a couple weeks' time, probably right when this airs.
Mm-hmm.
And then what else? Oh, we're shooting a show with Drew Carey called The Drew Carey's Improvaganza. That'll come out in, like, March.
Yeah.
I'm on Facebook and I'm on Twitter.
Greg Proops? You're just Greg Proops on Twitter?
Yeah, I'm Greg Proops on Twitter. I'm Greg Proops on Facebook. No, I'm not the Greg Proops or Proops24. What's Ashton Kutcher's?
A plus K.
Did you know the little thing where you have to your little bio?
Yeah.
You know, people write, like, I'm an actor, or yours is what? This is my thing.
I'm Chris Hardwick and these are my tweets.
Yeah, these are my tweets. That's funny. Mine says something like, buy low and stay high, or something stupid. Ashton Kutcher's is like, I put together dreams. I put together... Have you ever read his? Go on it.
No.
It's like, dreams and ideas, and I turn them into reality. That's
Dreamweaver.
I tell stories.
I believe
and you think, why put that there? This is supposed to be the entertaining part of your career. It's called Twitter because Twitter is the essence of it. Just Twitter something off.
Yeah.
Don't hit me with fucking... I make dreams out of metal.
Not here.
And no, not you here. Don't. You're using 140 characters to promote some bullshit you thought of.
Yeah, you know, exactly. I like to crochet dreams into the fabric of reality.
What? No, you don't. You're a fucking douche.
You don't
douche.
Do that at all.
Tell your shitty jokes, douche. You know, it's like, that's what I don't get.
Three pictures of your wife. That's about it.
Frankly, you know, when you read, like, Britney's or Lady Gaga, whatever, you know, the really shallow end, you know, the Demi Lovato end of Twitter, it's perfect.
Right.
Theirs are perfect. Those are the perfect ones.
Yeah.
Kim Kardashian's in South Beach. Wow. Well, dig it. That's a Twitter. You
140 characters. It is an innately shallow medium, physically shallow medium. And so that sort of should reflect how, you know.
Snookies are great. Word up to JWoww, girl. You know, like, you're just like, really? Yeah. And you believe, I believe she writes them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, anything else, the book, whatever, I don't think she writes. But the Twitters, I think, no. Because there's pictures and stuff, you know. Like,
man.
Down with my peeps. Yeah. You know, right? And then a picture of a bunch of people, and you go, fucking Snooki, you murdered the tweet, man. Like, but it's, you know, like, you think a book, no, that's not made for you. But Twitter.
Perfect.
That's made for you.
There you go. All right.
Yeah, we gotta go.
We gotta go. Enjoy your burrito.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.
Girls Fight Back is the world-renowned personal safety and empowerment-based self-defense company that teaches women and people of all gender identities how to live confidently while being their own best protector. As a leading voice on violence prevention and empowerment for over 20 years, Girls Fight Back has trained over 1 million people around the world since 2001.
Their engaging workshops create a safe environment for groups to learn evidence-backed, life-saving skills, emphasizing that self-defense education is about more than just physical resistance. Girls Fight Back, led by CEO Nicole Snell, provides audiences with a range of applicable safety strategies that can be used in any setting so that you can lead a badass life.
To learn more about Girls Fight Back and to bring their award-winning trainings and seminars to your community, visit girlsfightback.com. That's girlsfightback.com.